West of Arkham, the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically, and where thin brooklets trickle without ever having caught the glint of sunlight. On the gentler slopes, there are farms ancient and rocky, with squat, moss-coated cottages brooding eternally over New England secrets, in the lee of great ledges. But these are all vacant now, with wide chimneys crumbling and the shingled sides bulging perilously beneath low gambrel roofs. The old folk have gone away, and foreigners do not like to live there. French Canadians have tried it, Italians have tried it, and the Poles have come and departed. It is not because of anything that can be seen, heard, or handled, but because of something that is imagined. The place is not good for the imagination, and does not bring restful dreams at night. It must be this which keeps the foreigners away, for old Amy Pierce has never told them of anything he recalls from the strange days. Amy, whose head has been a little queer for years, is the only one who still remains, or who ever talks of the strange days, and he dares to do this because his house is so near the open fields and the travelled roads around Arkham. There was once a road over the hills and through the valleys that ran straight where the blasted heath is now, but people ceased to use it, and the new road was laid, curving far towards the south. Traces of the old one can still be found amongst the weeds of a returning wilderness, and some of them will doubtless linger even when half the hollows are flooded for the new reservoir. Then the dark woods will be cut down, and the blasted heath will slumber far below blue waters whose surface will mirror the sky and ripple in the sun. And the secrets of the strange days will be one with the deep secrets, one with the hidden lore of old ocean and all the mysteries of primal earth. When I went into the hills and vales to survey for the new reservoir, they told me the place was evil. They told me this in Arkham, and because that is a very old town full of witch legends, I thought the evil must be something which grandams had whispered to children through centuries. The name Blasted Heath seemed to be very odd and theatrical, and I wondered how it came into folklore of a Puritan people. Then I saw the dark westward tangle of glens and slopes for myself, and ceased to wonder at anything besides its own elder mystery. It was morning when I saw it, but shadows lurked always there. The trees grew too thickly, and their trunks were too big for any healthy New England wood. There was too much silence in the dim alleys between them, and the floor was too soft with the dank moss of mattings of infinite years of decay. In the open spaces, mostly along the line of the old road, there were little hillside farms, sometimes with all the buildings standing, sometimes with only one or two, and sometimes with only a lone chimney or fast-filling cellar. Weeds and briars reigned, and furtive wild things rustled in the undergrowth. Upon everything was a haze of restlessness and oppression, a touch of the unreal and the grotesque, as if some vital element of perspective or chiaroscuro were awry. I did not wonder that the foreigners would not stay, for this was no region to sleep in. It was too much like a landscape of Salvador Rosa, too much like some forbidden woodcut in a tale of terror. But even all this was not as bad as the blasted heath. I knew at the moment I came upon it at the bottom of a spacious valley, for no other name could fit such a thing, or any other thing fits such a name. It was as if the poet had coined the phrase from having seen this one particular region. It must, I thought as I viewed it, be the outcome of a fire. But why had nothing new ever grown over these 5 acres of grey desolation that sprawled open to the sky like a great spot eaten by acid in the woods and fields? It lay largely to the north of the ancient road line, but encroached a little on the other side. I felt an odd reluctance about approaching, and did so at last only because my business took me through it and past it. There was no vegetation of any kind on that broad expanse. but only a fine grey dust or ash which no wind seemed ever to blow about. The trees near it were sickly and stunted, and many dead trunks stood or lay rotting at the rim. As I walked hurriedly by, I saw the tumbled bricks and stones of an old chimney and cellar on my right, and the yawning black maw of an abandoned well whose stagnant vapours played strange tricks with the hues of the sunlight. Even the long, dark woodland climb beyond seemed welcome in contrast, and I marvelled no more at the frightened whispers of Arkham people. There had been no house or ruin near, even in the old days. The place must have been lonely and remote. And at twilight, dreading to repass that ominous spot, I walked circuitously back to the town by the curving road to the south. I vaguely wished some clouds would gather, for an odd timidity about the deep skyey voids above had crept into my soul. In the evening, I asked old people in Arkham about the blasted heath, and what was meant by the phrase strange days, which so many evasively muttered. I could not, however, get any good answers, except that all the mystery was much more recent than I had dreamed. It was not a matter of old legend at all, but something within the lifetime of those who spoke. It had happened in the 80s, and a family had disappeared or was killed. Speakers would not be exact, and because they all told me to pay no attention to old Amy Pierce's crazy tales, I sought him out for the next morning. Having heard that he lived alone in the ancient tottering cottage where the trees first began to get very thick. It was a fearsomely archaic place, and had begun to exude the faintest miasmal odour which clings about houses that have stood too long. Only with persistent knocking could I rouse the aged man. When he shuffled timidly to the door, I could tell he was not glad to see me. He was not as feeble as I had expected, but his eyes drooped in a curious way, and his unkempt clothing and white beard made him seem very worn and dismal. Not knowing just how he could best be launched onto his tales, I feigned a matter of business, told him of my surveying, and asked vague questions about the district. He was far brighter and more educated than I had been led to think, and before I knew it, had grasped quite as much of the subject as any man I had talked with in Arkham. He was not like other rustics I had known in the sections where reservoirs were to be. From him there were no protests at the miles of old wood and farmland to be blotted out, though perhaps there would have been had his home not laid outside the bounds of the future lake. Relief was all that he shewed, relief at the doom of the dark ancient valleys through which he had roamed all his life. They were better under water now. Better under water since the strange days, and with this opening his husky voice sank low, while his body leaned forward and his right forefinger began to point shakily and impressively. It was then that I heard the story, and as that rambling voice scraped and whispered on, I shivered again and again despite the summer day. Often I had to recall the speaker from ramblings, piece out scientific points which he had only a fading parrot memory of professor's talk, or bridge over gaps where his sense of logic and continuity broke down. When he was done, I did not wonder that his mind had snapped a trifle, but that the folk of Arkham would not speak much of the blasted heath. I hurried back before sunset to my hotel, unwilling to have the stars come out above me in the open, and the next day returned to Boston to give up my position. I could not go into that dim chaos of old forest and slope again, or face another time that grey blasted heath where the black well yawned deep beside the tumbled bricks and stones. The reservoir will soon be built now, and all those elder secrets will be safe forever under watery fathoms. But even then, I do not believe I would like to visit that country by night. At least not when the sinister stars are out, and nothing could bribe me to drink the new city water of Arkham. It all began, old Amy had said, with the meteorite. Before that time, there had been no wild legends at all since the witch trials, and even then these western woods were not feared half as much as the small island in the Miskatonic, where the devil held court beside a curious stone altar older than the Indians. These were not haunted woods, and their fantastic dusk were never terrible till the strange days. Then there had come that white noontide cloud, that string of explosions in the air, and that pillar of smoke from the valley far in the wood. And by night all Arkham had heard of the great rock that fell out of the sky and embedded itself in the ground beside the well at the Nahum Gardner place. That was the house which had stood where the blasted heath was to come. The trim white Nahum Gardner house amidst its fertile gardens and orchards. Nahum had come to town to tell people about the stone and had dropped in at Ammie Pierce's on the way. Ammie was 40 then, and all the queer things were fixed very strongly in his mind. He and his wife had gone with the three professors from Miskatonic University, who hastened out the next morning to see the weird visitor from unknown stellar space, and had wondered why Nahum had called it so large the day before. It had shrunk, Nahum said, as he pointed out the brownish mound above the ripped earth and the charred grass near the archaic well sweep in his front yard. But the wise men answered that stones do not shrink. Its heat lingered persistently, and Nahum declared that it glowed faintly in the night. The professors tried it with the geologist's hammer and found it was oddly soft. It was, in truth, so soft as to be almost plastic, and they gouged rather than chipped a specimen to take back to the college for testing. They took it in an old power barrow from Nahum's kitchen, for even the small piece refused to grow cool. On the trip back, they stopped at Ammie's to rest, and seemed thoughtful when Mrs. Pierce remarked that the fragment was growing smaller and burning the bottom of the pail. Truly, it was not large, but perhaps they had taken less than they thought. The day after that, all this was in June of 82, the professors had trooped out again in a great excitement. As they passed Ammie's, they told him what queer things the specimen had done, and how it faded wholly away when they put it in a glass beaker. The beaker had gone too, and the wise men talked of a strange stone's affinity for silicon. It had acted quite unbelievably in that well-ordered laboratory, doing nothing at all and shewing no occluded gases when heated on charcoal, being wholly negative in the borax bead, and soon proving itself absolutely non-volatile at any producible temperature, including that of oxyhydrogen blowpipe. On an anvil it appeared highly malleable, and in the dark its luminosity was very marked. Stubbornly refusing to grow cool, it soon had the college in its state of real excitement, and when, upon heating before the spectroscope, it displayed shining bands unlike any known colours of the normal spectrum, there was much breathless talk of new elements, bizarre optical properties, and other things which puzzled men of science are wont to say when faced by the unknown. Hot as it was, they tested it in a crucible with all the proper reagents. Water did nothing, hydrochloric acid was the same, nitric acid and even aqua regia merely hissed and spattered against its torrid invulnerability. Ammie had difficulty in recalling all these things, but recognised some solvents as I mentioned them in the usual order of use. There were ammonia and caustic soda, alcohol and ether, nauseous carbon disulfate and a dozen others. But although the weight grew steadily less as time passed, and the fragments seemed to be slightly cooling, there was no change in the solvents to shew that they had attacked the substance at all. It was a metal, though beyond a doubt. It was magnetic, for one thing, and after its immersion in the acid solvents, there seemed to be a faint traces of the Wildmannsstatin figures found on meteoric iron. When the cooling had grown very considerable, the testing was carried out in glass, and it was in a glass beaker that they left all the chips made of the original fragment during the work. The next morning, both chips and beaker were gone without a trace, and only a charred spot marked the place on the wooden shelf where they had been. All this the professors told Ammie as they paused at his door, and once more he went with them to see the stony messenger from the stars, though this time his wife did not accompany him. It had now almost certainly shrunk, and even the sober professors could not doubt the truth of what they saw. All around the dwindling brown lump near the well was a vacant space, except where the earth had caved in. And whereas it had been a good 7 feet across the day before, it was now scarcely 5. It was still hot, and the sages studied its surface curiously as they detached another and larger piece with the hammer and chisel. They gouged deeply this time as they pried away the smaller mass. They saw that the core of the thing was not quite homogeneous. They had uncovered what seemed to be the side of a large coloured globule embedded in the substance, the colour which resembled some of the bands of the meteorite's strange spectrum. Was almost impossible to describe. It was only by analogy that they called it a colour at all. Its texture was glossy, and upon tapping it appeared to promise both brittleness and hollowness. One of the professors gave it a smart blow with a hammer, and it burst with a nervous little pop. Nothing was emitted, and all trace of the thing vanished with the puncturing. It left behind a hollow spherical space about 3 inches across, and all thought it probable the others would be discovered as the enclosing substance wasted away. Conjecture was vain, so after a futile attempt to gain additional globules by drilling, the seekers left again with their new specimen, which proved, however, as baffling in the laboratory as its predecessor had been. Aside from being almost plastic, having heat, magnetism, and slight luminosity, cooling slightly in powerful acids, possessing an unknown spectrum, wasting away in air, and attacking silicon compounds with mutual destruction as a result. It presented no identifying features whatsoever. And at the end of the tests, the colleague scientists were forced to own that they could not place it. It was nothing of this earth, but a piece of the great outside, and as such dowered with outside properties and obedient to outside laws. The night there was a thunderstorm, and when the professors went out to Nahum's the next day, they met with bitter disappointment. The stone, magnetic as it had been, must have been some peculiar electrical property, for it had drawn the lightning, as Nahum said, with a singular persistence. 6 times within an hour, the farmer saw the lightning strike the furrow in the front yard, and when the storm was over, nothing remained but a ragged pit by the ancient well sweep, half choked with caved-in earth. Digging had borne no fruit, and the scientists verified the fact of the utter vanishment. The failure was total, so that nothing was left to do but go back to the laboratory and test again the disappearing fragment left carefully cased in lead. That fragment lasted a week, at the end of which nothing of value had been learned of it. When it had gone, no residue was left behind, and in the time professors felt scarcely sure they had indeed seen with waking eyes that cryptic vestige of the fathomless gulfs outside, that lone, weird message from the other universes and the other realms of matter, force and entity. As was natural, the Arkham papers made much of the incident with its collegiate sponsoring and sent reporters to talk with Nahum Gardner and his family. At least one Boston daily also sent a scribe, and Nahum quickly became a kind of local celebrity. He was a lean, genial person of about 50, living with his wife and 3 sons on the pleasant farmstead of the valley. He and Amy exchanged visits frequently, as did their wives, and Amy had nothing but praise for him after all these years. He seemed slightly proud of the notice his palm had attracted, and talked often of the meteorite in the succeeding weeks. That July and August were hot, and Nahum worked hard at his haying in the 10-acre pasture across Chapman's Brook, his rattling wain wearing deep ruts in the shadowy lanes between. The labour tired him more than it had in any other years, and he felt that age was beginning to tell on him. Then fell the time of fruit and harvest. The pears and apples slowly ripened, and Nahum vowed that his orchard were prospering as never before. The fruit was growing to phenomenal size and unwanted gloss, as in such an abundance that extra barrels were ordered to handle the fruity crop. But lusciousness, not of one single jot, was fit to eat. Into the fine flavour of these pears and apples had crept a stealthy bitterness and sickishness, so that even the smallest bites induced a lasting disgust. It was the same with the melons and tomatoes, and Nahum sadly saw that his entire crop was lost. Quick to connect events, he declared that the meteorite had poisoned the soil and thanked heaven that most of the other crop were in the upland along the road. Winter came early and it was very cold. Ami saw Nahum less often than usual and observed that he began to look worried. The rest of his family too seemed to have grown taciturn and were far from steady in their church going or their attendance at the various social events at the countryside. For this reserve or melancholy, no cause could be found, though all the household confessed now and then to poorer health and a feeling of vague disquiet. Nahum himself gave the most definite statement of anyone when he said he was disturbed about certain footprints in the snow. They were the usual winter prints of red squirrels, white rabbits and foxes, but the brooding farmer professed to see something not quite right about the nature and arrangement. He was never specific, but appeared to think that they were not as characteristic of the anatomy and habits of squirrels and rabbits and foxes as they ought to be. Ami listened without interest to his talk until one night when he drove past Nahum's house in the sleigh on the way back from Clark's Corner. There had been a moon and a rabbit had run across the road, and the leaps of that rabbit were longer than either Ami or his horse liked. The latter, indeed, had almost run away when he brought up by firm rein. Thereafter, Ami gave Nahum's tales less more respect and wondered why the gardener dog seemed so cowed and quivering every moment. They had, it developed, nearly lost the spirit to bark. In February, the McGregor boys from the Meadow Hill were out shooting woodchucks, and not far from the gardener place bagged a very peculiar specimen. The proportions of its body seemed slightly altered in a queer way, impossible to describe, while its face had taken an expression which no one ever saw in a woodchuck before. The boys were genuinely frightened and threw the thing away at once, so that only the grotesque tales of it ever reached the people of the countryside. But the shying of the horses near Nahum's house had not become an acknowledged thing, and all the basics for a cycle of whispered legend that was fast taking form. People vowed that the snow melted faster around Nahum's than it did anywhere else, and early in March there was an awed discussion in Potter's General Store at Clark's Corner. Stephen Rice had driven past Gardner's in the morning and had noticed the skunk cabbages coming up through the mud by the woods and across the road. Never were things of such size been before, and they held strange colours that could not be put into any words. Their shapes were monstrous, and the horse had snorted at an odour which struck Stephen as wholly unprecedented. That afternoon several persons drove past to see an abnormal growth, and all agreed that plants of that kind ought never sprout in a healthy world. The bad fruit of the fall before was freely mentioned, and it went from mouth to mouth that there was poison in Nahum's ground. Of course it was the meteorite, and remembering how strange the men from the college had found such stone to be, several farmers spoke about the matter to them. One day they paid Nahum a visit, but having no love of wild tales and folklore were very conservative in what they inferred. The plants were certainly odd, but all skunk cabbages are more or less odd in shape and odour and hue. Perhaps some mineral element from the stone had entered the soil, but it would soon be washed away, and as for the footprints of frightened horses, of course this was mere country talk, which such a phenomenon as the aerolite would be certain to start. There was really nothing for serious men to do in a case as a wild gossip, for superstitious rustics will say and believe anything. And so, all through the strange days, the professors stayed away in contempt. Only one of them, when given 2 files of dust for analysis in a police job over a year and a half later, recalled that the queer colour of the skunk cabbages had been like one of the anomalous bands of light shewn by the meteor fragment in the college spectroscope, and like the brittle globule found embedded in the stone from the abyss. The samples in this analysis case gave the same odd bands at first, though later they lost that property. The trees budded prematurely around Nahum's, and at night they swayed ominously in the wind. Nahum's second son, Thaddeus, a lad of 15, swore that they swayed also when there was no wind. But even the gossips could not credit this. Certainly, however, restlessness was in the air. The entire Gardner family developed the habit of stealthily listening, though not for any sound which they could consciously name. The listening was, indeed, rather a product of moments when consciousness seemed half to slip away. Unfortunately, such moments increased week by week, till it became common speech that something was wrong with all Nahum's folks. When the early saxifrage came out, it had another strange colour, not quite like that of the skunk cabbage, but plainly related and equally unknown to anyone who saw it. Nahum took some blossoms to Arkham and shewed them to the editor of the Gazette, but that dignitary did no more than write a humorous article about them, in which the dark fears of rustics were held up to polite ridicule. It was a mistake of Nahum's to tell a stolid city man about the way the great overgrown mourning cloak butterflies behaved in connection with these saxifrages. April brought a kind of madness to the country folk, and began that disuse of the road past Nahum's which led to its ultimate abandonment. It was the vegetation, or the orchard trees blossomed forth in strange colours, and through the stony soil of the yard and adjacent pasturage there sprang up bizarre growth which only a botanist could connect with the proper flora of the region. No sane, wholesome colours were anywhere to be seen except in the green grass and leafage. But everywhere those hectic and prismatic variants of some diseased, underlying primary tone without a place amongst the known tints of earth. The Dutchman's breeches became a thing of sinister menace, and the bloodroots grew insolent in their chromatic perversion. Amy and the gardeners thought that most of the colours had a sort of haunting familiarity, and decided that they reminded one of the brittle globule in the meteor. Nahum ploughed and sowed the 10-acre pasture and the upland allot, but did nothing with the land around the house. He knew it would be of no use, and hoped that the summer's strange growths would draw all the poison from the soil. He was prepared for almost anything now, and had grown used to the sense of something near him waiting to be heard. The shunning of his house by neighbours told him, of course, but it told of his wife more. The boys were better off being at school each day, but they could not help being frightened by the gossip. Thaddeus, an especially sensitive youth, suffered the most. In May, the insects came, and Nahum's place became a nightmare of buzzing and crawling. Most of the creatures seemed not quite usual in their aspect and motion, and their nocturnal habits contradicted all former experience. The gardeners took to watching at night, watching in all directions at random for something. They could not tell what. It was then that they all owned that Thaddeus had been right about the trees. Miss Gardner was the next to see it from the window as she watched the swollen boughs of the maple against the moonlit sky. The boughs surely moved, and there was no wind. It must be the sap. Strangeness had come into everything growing now, yet it was none of Nahum's family at all who made the next discovery. Familiarity had dulled them, and what they could not see was glimpsed by the timid windmill salesman from Bolton, who drove by one night in ignorance of the country legends. What he told in Arkham was given a short paragraph in the Gazette, and it was there that the farmers, Nahum included, saw it first. The night had been dark, and the buggy lamps faint, but around the farm in the valley, which everyone knew from the account must be Nahum's, the darkness had been less thick. A dim, though distinct luminosity, seemed to inhere all the vegetation, grass, leaves and blossoms alight. While at one moment a detached piece of the phosphorus appeared to stir furtively in the yard near the barn,